You're listening to In His Sign Catholic Radio on WTMR 800, Camden, Philadelphia.
Do not let your hearts be troubled or afraid. Dear brothers and sisters, the Holy Spirit is with you.
I'm Kathleen McCarthy, and you're listening to What the World Needs Now, empowered by the Holy Spirit, bringing the fire of God's love to the world. I invite you to join me in this hour of God's healing power. Call and join us in conversation and prayer. Remember, what the world needs now is God, and God is love.
And welcome to What the World Needs Now. This is your host, Ken Johnston. I'll be with you for the next hour, and I think we have a pretty exciting show for you today. But before we go to our guest, I just want to praise and thank God for all of our listeners and benefactors, those of you that continue to pray for us here at In His Sign and provide that financial support that's allowed us to be on the air for over 40 years now here in this local market with this radio apostolate. We can't thank you enough, and we just ask you to continue to do whatever you can to support us here and enable us to bring shows to you like today's. And I am excited about the show today. I just had a 15-second conversation with Father Weta about his new book. And J. Augustine Weta is a monk of St. Louis Abbey. He serves as director of chaplaincy at the St. Louis Priory School, where he teaches and coaches rugby. During his spare time, Father Augustine supervises the juggling team, cultivates carnivorous plants, raises carpenter ants, and surfs. And when I read this, Father, it sounded like if I were a drinking guy, I'd love to get together with you sometime and have a couple of cold ones. Mine will be a Coke. But
Well, St. Benedict has a specific rule about drinking, that each monk is guaranteed a hemina of wine every day.
There you go.
So, yeah, it's a topic hotly debated among monks, exactly how much a hemina is. But.
Oh, I can imagine. I can imagine. But I saw your picture, actually, out on Amazon. And young guy, I saw a little bit more in your biography about your conversion and having gone to undergrad at Rice, and then I guess it was during graduate school that you visited the Abbey there in St. Louis, and I guess fell in love with the life of a monk. And
And falling in love is really the right term for it. I don't even know if I should tell this story on the air, but I will anyway. What the heck? We'll push the envelope. When I was in grad school, I'm one of these ADD types, and during lectures, I used to draw pictures in the margins of my notes. At the time, I was, not so much engaged, but very close to it with a very beautiful woman. And I used to draw her eyes in the corners of my notes, trying to get her eyes right. And but then I started visiting the monastery, and I noticed, looking over my notes, that at some point I had stopped drawing her eyes, and I had started drawing little pictures of monks in the margins of my notes. I thought, Uh-oh.
Yeah.
So it really was like falling in love. You got that exactly right.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I just had a conversation in the last couple of weeks with my sister who has a daughter that's a senior at Catholic U, and talking about it, I always thought that she would make an ideal nun. And my sister's, no way, she's getting married, she's going to have a family. And I was like, well, you better support her in whatever decision.
Well, you need good
families, too. Yeah, yeah. But,
by the way, before we get started, I have to give a shout-out. Is that okay?
Can that's I do fine. That? Absolutely.
My seventh grade theology class is listening as we speak, and they told me if I was going to miss class, that I had to give a shout out to them. So, and in particular to one student named Calmkill Ruttinghouse. So a big shout out to my seventh grade theology class and Calmkill Ruttinghouse.
Awesome.
What a name, huh?
Absolutely. And glad they're listening either over the internet or however they're getting it. That's wonderful, especially with technology today. Yeah. So you're going through this conversion. You become a monk. And now you've come up with this wonderful book called Humility Rules, St. Benedict's 12-Step Guide to Genuine Self-Esteem.
And, yeah, and depending on where you live, it's either Humility Rules or Humility Rules.
So, yeah.
If you're on the beach, it's Humility Rules.
There you go, with your hand up, right, with the surf signal.
Yeah.
But
the hang 10 signal is actually, hang loose is what it is. And it's, you extend the thumb and the pinky, and it's supposed to represent your five toes of your right foot hanging over the nose of the board.
How about that?
So there's your surf lesson for today.
And I was just going to say that you never know what you're going to learn here at what the world needs now. But
the world needs more hang loose signs.
Yeah, and I think it could use a little dose of humility too. And as I as we mentioned right before the show, being somebody that's in recovery and working the 12-step program, I found it real interesting that we have a 12-step guide to genuine self-esteem. And one of the things you hear often in the rooms of recovery be somebody saying that, you know, I have no self-esteem, or, you know, I suffered with a lack of self-esteem. And what you come to learn later is sometimes self-esteem can really be a hindrance, especially in the spiritual life, can't it?
Yeah, full disclosure here, the title is misleading. It was deliberately misleading. I don't actually believe in self-esteem.
Right.
I think there's... Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's all right, go ahead.
Oh, I'm hearing myself. I think there's an excess of self-esteem. We walk around telling kids these empty platitudes like, be true to yourself and follow your dreams and you're perfect just the way you are. And these are all basically empty, narcissistic lies, you know. Mm-hmm. Part of the start of this book was that I was visiting a pharmacy nearby, picking up some medicine for some of my elderly brethren. And you know, they have these self-help books on the rack next to the counter, and one of them was the Teen's Guide. I hope I get the title wrong so I don't get sued, but anyway, the title was The Teen's Guide to Self-Esteem: Learning to Love the Most Important Person in the World. You.
Yeah.
And I looked at the pharmacist and I was like, this is the worst advice you could ever give a teenager. Like, number one, they already think they're the center of the world, and this just reinforces it. And number two, if they don't think they're the center of the world, think of the pressure this puts on them, you know? Mm. I mean, every act we do is infinitely significant, but lucky for us, we're not the center of the world. Christ is, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's
I can't imagine St. John the Baptist talking about his self-esteem, right?
No, absolutely not. I mean, it was just the opposite, right? I'm not even worthy to loosen the sandal on his shoe, or loosen the sandal on his feet.
And I must decrease.
Right. And a lot of times the conversations I'll have with people that are struggling with addiction, it's the idea that you surrender to win, that we give up.
Yeah.
And move all that dependence that we have on whatever it is that we're using to get through life, and find that dependence on God. who really wants us to give us the joy, you know, real joy, not these fleeting pleasures that so many of us seek out, but that true joy and serenity that only God can provide. And
somewhere in the, I think in the Confessions of St. Augustine, though it could be elsewhere, he says, it's only when I acknowledge that Satan had won the battle that I began to gain the upper hand.
Right.
And I often think back to that, that he won in a way, and but then he won against me, but Jesus won against him. So right. As long as I focus on Jesus, I win.
Yeah, he won the battle, we're going to win the war.
We already won the war. See, we have a camp here at the Abbey. Well, I live in a monastery that runs a school, and every summer we have what's called monk camp. And one year I told them a story that was so scary, none of them would go to sleep. And I had to explain to them that, you know, scary stories are fun precisely because evil has no power over us. Jesus won the battle. All you have to do is say his name, and every evil force in the world and under the world must take a knee, right?
That's right.
So we won. The battle's over. The victory is ours.
Absolutely. And so the whole idea of humility and the idea for this book, I'm assuming just based on a little that I've read of it so far, is based on St. Benedict and his rule and what you've come to learn about humility as a direct result of being a student of Benedict, right?
Well, right. And he says he calls it the ladder of humility, and he refers to Jacob's ladder and the angels going up and down this ladder. And he says, the funny thing about this ladder is that the higher you climb, the lower you get. And that's the beauty of this particular ladder. And then I kind of took the liberty of renaming his steps.
No, very good. And I a lot of them I can certainly relate to. And as you go through the book, just a couple of notes for those that are listening. There is great artwork all through this that, you know, you have the opportunity to use some of it. Some of it, I think, is direct, and some of it is definitely manipulated. But it gives you the true sense of what Father Weta is trying to bring out in the book.
Well, the key to the artwork is that, once I started writing the book, and there's a story behind that, too. We had this wonderful shrink at St. Louis, counselor at the school, who called, of all things, Dr. Fury. And he and I would go back and forth with these cliches, and that's how we came up with the titles for the various chapters. Don't be true to yourself. Don't follow your dreams. Put your worst foot forward. The point of the book was to climb this ladder of humility, to lay out this ladder for the students so that they could maybe find real self-esteem.
Absolutely. And when you go through it, it's a couple of
pages. Oh, sorry. We were talking about the illustrations. There you go. That's my ADD getting in the way. So I started reading all these self-help books, or at least trying to read them. Most of them are unreadable. And the worst part about them was the artwork. It's just filled with this sort of cheesy stick figures, you know, this trying to be cool for the kids sort of thing. And my mother is a kind of a famous artist, and so I've grown up around real art. And I just knew if I was going to publish this book, that if the artwork was bad, I was never going to hear the end of it.
Oh, so, I'm sure.
So rather than creating my own, I just went on the internet and found old manuscript illustrations of monks and photoshopped little things into them, details like skateboards and iPods and surfboards and things like that.
Yep. And but it definitely it brings out the idea as you go through it. So,
well, and I'm surprised at how much people like these illustrations. They're buying the book for the illustrations, and I guess reading it for the text, I hope.
Yeah, no, and I think there's a whole lot to be learned. So just in Benedict's teaching, this ladder has two sides, right?
Right. Yes, the body and the soul. So each step. I've divided it into three parts: the mind, Now I've forgotten my own book. Thought, Word, and Deed. So body and soul, and then act. And that's another thing about Christianity that I think people miss, especially in this country, is that it's not just a religion of the book. It's a religion of sacrament, and it's a religion of play, and it's a religion of song, and it's as much even, well, the soul is more important than the body, but the body shouldn't be scorned or neglected either. It's, we're going to get it back someday, and it's pretty important, and it's part, we can pray with our bodies too. People tend to forget that.
I'm assuming that in his and it says it right in your book, so I don't have to assume that in the in the chapter on humility that Benedict has in his rule, he lays out the 12 steps or the 12 rungs on this ladder. And I thought with the time that we have, maybe to go through some of these. And
sure.
So the first step is to be afraid. In Benedict's terms, it was to fear of God. And I think a lot of times when people hear fear of God, that it kind of totes something negative, and you know, it right away people go back to the 1950s and say, "Oh, that's that that God that the nuns taught us about," and you know, we need to walk around in fear, and that's really not what fear of God is it?
No, it isn't. And I also think the nuns get a bad rep.
Yep.
You know, I don't know that they were as mean, or as many of them as mean as they say. I had nuns in grade school, and they didn't slap my knuckles or whatever. I think some of this is a myth that has evolved into legend, or vice versa. But anyway, I owe a lot to the Dominicans that taught me, and I was never rapped on the knuckles.
Me neither. I had the Sisters of Mercy. So,
but even so, you know, my mother insists on showing me pictures of her youth, and one of them was of her grade school, and there are maybe 70 kids in that classroom and one nun.
Right.
And I thought, well, if I were that nun, if I weren't rapping knuckles, I'd certainly start doing it pretty soon. I mean, I can't imagine. It's hard enough teaching 16 seventh graders, say nothing of, 50 or 60 in a classroom.
Yeah, you hear that, guys?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You're lucky. When I was your age, I had to walk through snow in my bare feet uphill just to get to class, and then
both ways.
Got feet on the knuckles.
Yeah,
but fear of God. I'm hoping they'll at least fear me. But anyway, at least fear God. Maybe fear me in the process. But we'll see. I don't think they're very afraid of me at all.
Good for them.
Truth be told.
Yeah, I don't think so.
I think. C.S. Lewis, he's not canonized yet. He said something about, people prefer, these days people don't so much want a heavenly father as a heavenly grandfather, a sort of senile old dude who doesn't much care what the young folk do so long as nobody gets hurt. I think that's a real mistake to think of God that way. Obviously the goal is that perfect love, which drives out fear, right? But in the meantime, if you don't know where you're going, at least know where you want to avoid, and that's hell. And God is a judge, and there are plenty of descriptions in the Bible of Jesus that aren't as comforting as others. You know, he's supposed to come back the second time on riding on a cloud with his name carved in blood on his thigh, and he's the judge of judges that will rule with an iron rod. And Jesus himself says things like, talks about wailing and gnashing of teeth and get away from me, you evildoers, and so on and so forth. So if you're not at least in awe of that power, I think you probably need to reexamine your priorities.
Yeah. Yeah, I also think, too, that even if we use a human example, that and it's not so much fear, but if we love someone, you know, like I love my wife, it's the fear of hurting her, the fear, by the things that we do. We don't want to hurt the ones we love, and if we love God, we don't want to, you know, we don't want to hurt or offend those that we love, and especially God. So if we keep that in the forefront of our minds, then there's a fear of hurting them, or that helps us to avoid some of those temptations that we may have.
Yeah, it's not so much that we see God as this sort of old dude up on a computer, you know, just itching to hit the smite button, you know, so much as, yeah, someone that we love and someone we adore. I had a friend in college who was an evangelical, and she said when she died, she thought she would throw herself into Jesus' arms. And that, my faith, that's a valid response, to be sure. But my response would be to throw myself at his feet.
Right.
And I think those are equally valid reactions. It was certainly St. Peter's reaction when he met Jesus was to throw himself on the ground and say, get away from me, leave me, I am a sinful man, right?
Amen.
I mean, I think sometimes we can get into the habit of feeling like Jesus should be grateful for our friendship. When I first joined the monastery, when I began my novitiate, our old Father Luke was my novice master, and he asked me what I had to offer, I remember vividly thinking about it and saying, well, okay, I'm smart, I'm hardworking, and I'm clean. And he said, well, you're not ready. And every day he'd ask me the same question, and I'd try to think of some other reason why the monastery should take me, and every day he'd tell me, you're not ready, you're not ready. And finally I just gave up, and I said, you know what, you probably shouldn't take me. Don't bother. And he said, now you're ready.
Right. And that actually leads into the second step on the ladder, right? You title it, Don't Good. Be True to Yourself. And Benedict would have called it self-denial.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that it really is counterculture, as the whole book is.
Oh, sure.
But that, especially for boys that were taught from an early age, if we work hard, do what we're supposed to do, we can have just about anything we want. And,
right.
And we, as a result, a lot of folks spend a lot of time in their lives trying to get things and get possessions,
yeah,
and make a name for themselves. And what we're called to as Christians, and especially as Catholics, is the complete opposite, is to deny yeah. ourselves, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, these days it feels like the only area you should really deny yourself is food. Like, you're expected to control yourself when it comes to food, but pretty much everything else, well, even then you should be able to eat all you want and never gain weight, right?
Mm, right.
But in every other aspect of your life, you should indulge yourself. And you often hear people say, oh, what a beautiful car, you deserve that, you know. And the truth is, you don't deserve any of it. None of us deserve any of it. And there's a certain, there's a real freedom in knowing that you don't deserve anything.
Right.
The great theologian Janis Joplin, right? She said, "What freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose."
Mm.
And I guess you were telling me about the 12-step program in AA, and right, there's that you really just cannot begin to make any progress until you admit that you're powerless, as I understand it.
Absolutely, it's the first step, and a lot of times that's the one that people really struggle with until, and they'll hang on the second half of the first step, which is that that their lives become unmanageable. And people can certainly admit a lot of times, oh, my life was unmanageable, I was doing things I had no business doing, and this and that. But they may struggle initially with that idea of being powerless, because we're told, like I said, you know, we have control. We can, if we read the right books, get the right degrees, that we can solve all the world's problems. And it's just not the case. And really, like you said with Janis Joplin, and once you admit that you're powerless, that you that the whole world does not revolve around you, that there is somebody or someone out there that's a whole lot bigger and better than you are, and not only that, but he wants you to depend on him, that life becomes that much easier. And as you were talking about the possessions, I have a good friend that's a diocesan priest, and the first time I visited his residence, I had known him for quite a while, and he invited me up to his residence, and it was in a nursing home or a senior residence. And so a lot of it was like a hospital would be, tile floors and what have you. And so I went up to his room, and sure enough, it was a tile floor with a single bed. and very stark. And, you know, I said to him, Father, can I at least, like, run down to Home Depot and buy you a carpet? You know, it'd be nice to have a rug here. And he says, Ken, you can get it. He goes, but then I'm going to have to vacuum it. And the time it's going to take me to take care of the rug takes away from other things that I want to do. And you could just see that how – and then I started looking at all the things that are in my house and the things that need to be dusted and cleaned and maintained. And they're not significant things. They're not real expensive things, but they're – because they're there, they demand attention. And go ahead.
You'll be edified to learn that at St. Louis Abbey, you are not allowed a comfortable chair in your room until you turn 65.
Wow.
Yeah, so I don't even think I have a chair in my room. It's just a bed and some bookshelves.
Yep, so you're either horizontal or on your knees, one or the other, right?
Yeah, more often horizontal, I'm sorry to say. Yeah, I was just thinking about what you said about being the center of the world and making someone else the center of your world, and it reminded me of a student I had. He decided he was an atheist about halfway through his high school career. Now that he's in college, ironically, he's decided he's a Catholic again. I think mainly because he realized it would annoy people more to be a Catholic than an atheist in college. I teach this ethics class, and he raised his hand, and he turned around to the group, and he said, you guys call yourselves Catholics, but I see you on the weekend, and I see what you do, and, you know, at least I'm true to myself. And I thought, you know, he's got a real point. You got to give a kid credit for having convictions like that. But one of the other kids turned around in his desk and he said, yeah, well, anybody could be true to himself. At least we're trying to be true to somebody better than us.
Wow.
I couldn't have said it better myself. I mean, anybody can be true to themselves. I mean, the trick is to be true to Jesus, right? To be true to someone perfect.
Right.
And that's more difficult, and also more reliable. I mean, who knows? That's a lot of pressure to put on yourself to be true to, well, whatever you happen to think up at any given moment. But St. Benedict calls that kind of monk a gyrovag, a guy who wanders around, a vagabond, a gyrovagabond. And he says they make up rules for themselves that happen to coincide with whatever they already believe.
Yeah. Yeah, and
we have an old monk in the monastery who, at the beginning of Lent every year, he says, "This year I'm going to fast without ceasing for the entire Lent whenever I'm not hungry." And the rules are easy to keep. You know, we people shop around for a church, you know, that happens to match what they already think. And I think G.K. Chesterton said, you don't need a church that's right when you're already right. You need a church that's right when you're wrong.
Right, right. We were just talking about something similar last night. You know, one of the phrases that upsets us people, especially Catholics in a 12-step program, is this use of the phrase, as I understand them. With the higher power and God as I understand them, and sometimes in those cases you can make God whoever you want, and you decide what God's rules are, and then you can live by them. So, it's a lot easier than finding and studying the Christian faith, the Catholic faith, and trying to abide by all the rules. And the interesting thing, like you said, you know, the example you gave, that, you know, we try to live up to those rules. And what a wonderful thing it is to have a God that recognizes the fact that we are going to stumble, and that when we do, that he's there, there for us. And he's probably there for us more in those circumstances than he is if we were doing everything right.
Yeah.
So, Father, we're at the bottom of the hour.
So, already? Half an hour?
Yeah, time flies when you're having fun. we're just going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll pick up the conversation with the third step, okay?
Cool.
All right.
Take some phone calls.
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I'll give out the numbers now. 610-527-2906, 610-527-2906. And for your students that are listening and calling long distance, if you don't want to pay for a toll call, you can get us at 888 888- 888-343-2484. That's 888-343-2484. Maybe one of your kids will pull their cell phone out during class and give us a ring.
But I'll give you extra credit.
There you go. All right, folks, don't go away. We're coming right back.
We thank God for our one, holy, Catholic and Apostolic Church, where Jesus remains present to us until the end of the age, in word and in sacrament. Catholic Radio shares in the ministry of the Church to proclaim the gospel to the ends of the earth. And In His Sign Catholic Radio has been doing so for over 30 years. Kathleen McCarthy and In His Sign have been empowered by the Holy Spirit to bring the fire of God's healing love to the world through Catholic radio and the internet. With God's grace, His word goes out, healing hearts and transforming lives. In His Sign proclaims the culture of life loud and clear in a culture of death. The ministry's mission is to evangelize, catechize, and to be a voice for those who have no voice, proclaiming the truth that will set all people free. To our faithful family and friends who stand with us, thank you for being missionaries with us by supporting In His Sign Catholic Radio. Without your monthly support of prayer and financial giving, our mission would not be able to continue. Our mission voice would be silenced. To our new listeners, please prayerfully consider joining our monthly circle of family and friends by partnering with us financially each month. All donations are completely tax deductible and go directly to our daily expenses, like the purchase of radio airtime and keeping the lights on. Kathleen McCarthy and all of the staff at In His Sign, except Kathleen's administrator, donate all of their time and talent on a volunteer basis at no expense to the ministry. Donations to In His Sign Catholic Radio may be sent to 136 Garrett Avenue, Rosemont, PA 19010, or you can donate securely at inhissign.com. Remember, without your prayers and financial support, our mission voice will be silenced.
And welcome to What the World Needs Now. Again, your host, Ken Johnston, and I'll be with you for about another 25 minutes. I want to thank you for being with us today. I also want to thank you for your ongoing financial and prayerful support that allows us to bring you shows like today's. And our guest today is Father Augustine Weta. He's a Benedictine monk at the St. Louis Abbey. And we just looked over during the break. Father, you're in St. Louis, I guess?
I sure am. Yep. St. Louis, Missouri.
Yeah, and
it's pretty cold here. It's 2 degrees this morning.
Wow. A little bit warmer here, although it was quite chilly here the last week and the week before, down around zero the one day. But anyway, one of the things I noticed, if you go to their website at stlouisabbey.org, they actually have a picture of, I don't know if it's all the monks, but a bunch of the monks on the homepage there. And it looks like only the guys over 65 got a chair.
It's true. I hadn't noticed that, but you're absolutely right. Only they get chairs. Okay. Lucky for me, I have to put in a personal plug for vocations here. Pray for vocations to St. Louis Abbey, because I am only one spot away from getting off the dishwashing rota. So if we can just get one more young guy in here, I'm off the hook.
There you go. There you go.
We've been lucky or blessed so far. We had to tear out our guest wing and build a new one for all the young guys coming in. So we're doing great, but we just need one more, and then I'm home free.
There you go. So if you're interested in becoming a Benedictine monk, you can go to stlouisabbey.org, and they actually have a link there, becoming a monk. You can learn.
Or just show up, and if we don't kick you out, then you've made it. That's how I did it.
Very good. I got a good friend of mine.
Kick me out.
Yeah, I got a good friend of mine that's been trying to discern a vocation. He's a little bit older in life, but I don't think he minds doing dishes. I may send him your way.
Oh, excellent. All right, he's in.
Paul, if
he's
you're
in. I don't care what he's like. If he'll do my dishes, he's in.
There you go. Paul Smith, if you're listening, you got to get in touch with Father Weta here. So, the reason we brought Father on actually was to talk about this wonderful book he's written called Humility Rules: St. Benedict's 12-Step Guide to Genuine Self-Esteem. And again, it's a play on words, and once you get your hands on the book, you understand why. And we've been having a wonderful conversation. Frank, our engineer, we're commenting over the break the way you carry yourself, Father, and the jovial nature. It just makes it great for us to be able to have a conversation. And while we talk about serious matters, life-threatening matters, if you will, especially when we talk about heaven and hell, to be able to talk about it in such a way that isn't real stern, and to be able to bring this information to folks. Yeah.
Part of the thing that surprised me about the first monks that I met was how joyful they were, and how contrary to my expectations. If you watch enough movies, you tend to think that monks walk around all day in glum silence with their hands under their scapulars, and their heads bowed, grumbling to themselves and sort of shuffling their feet. And it really, the silliness that goes on behind the scenes, I shudder to think. In fact, just the other day I watched our novices had stolen one of the golf carts and were careening off across campus, off-roading. And I thought, well, if anybody ever saw this, it would totally change their idea of what a monk's supposed to be like.
Very good. Yeah, because I would have to admit that I would have the same, the same thoughts in a cold, dark place. Always praying and never having time for a good laugh. And it sounds like it's the complete opposite, which is wonderful. And so
Benedict does say to be careful of laughter. And I actually gave a sermon this morning to the school. You've got to, actually St. Benedict forbids laughter, but there's been some debate about this. What the laughter that he forbids is the kind of laughter that sounds like, the kind of laughter that you use when you're making fun of someone,
right,
or laughing at a dirty joke. But life-giving, life-affirming laughter, God must have a sense of humor. Otherwise, how do you explain the naked mole rat or the giraffe or, Kim Jong-un? God's got to be laughing up there at some of this stuff.
Absolutely.
It's, on the other hand, the really best jokes are the ones that come right up to the line, without crossing it. And when I was in college, I lived with, 7 other rugby players, and things got pretty ridiculous around the house. But the most ridiculous thing was this 6'6", 280-pound prop named Ackerman, who lived with us, and he was a super nice guy, big as all get out, but he was also one of these sort of neat freaks, and he'd leave little stickers around the house with notes on them like, don't forget to wash your coffee mugs, and don't leave your laundry in the living room. And so we started leaving little notes for him, like, I ate your socks, they're sorry, leftovers in the fridge, and somebody whose cat did I saute for breakfast this morning, and finally, somebody, I remember, put a note on the phone that just said "Ack" on it. And someone else came along and wrote "Your mom" under it, which is not even very funny. But then a third person came along and wrote "Is dead" at the bottom and thought this was funny. Yeah. that what we didn't know was that poor Ackerman, his mom was in the hospital with heart condition. So he was about halfway to the hospital when he realized we were just joking, and he might have killed all seven of us if he hadn't been such a nice guy. So, you know, you really got to know who you're joking with when you you start the teasing.
Right.
You know?
Right. No, and it's true. And I know a lot of times I would even talk about my own laughter, and that usually before I get on the straight and narrow, that most of the time that laughter was just, as you said, it was laughing at people. And and now to be able to have that joy and to be able to laugh with people is such a gift. And I think so many people miss it, you know, and you know how difficult it is to be the butt of somebody's joke, or you know, to be laughed at, or and to be laughed at really is to be ridiculed. And to go from that to being able to be in a crowd that, you know, laughs together at something that's you know, genuinely humorous, and not at somebody's and not at somebody's pearl, if you will.
It's about building people up and not breaking them down. But that's a hard one to negotiate. And I spent a couple of years as a stand-up comic, and if I'm not careful when I'm preaching and I go off script, I can. You know, in fact, the other day, I was preaching to the school, and one of the kids in the front pew got up and left. And I was like, "Hey, buddy, you know, I didn't leave when you got here." And I started to sort of heckle him, and he turned around and he goes, "I'm going to confession." then I felt pretty bad about it.
Oops.
Myself.
Yeah.
You know, luckily then the laughter turned on me, so I can take it.
Yeah.
I think I can.
Yeah. Let's hope.
Anyway, you got to be careful with the laughter. And St. Benedict is very clear about that.
Right. So we did mention in the first segment about your book that it talks about the 12-step ladder of Benedict and comes out of his chapter in his rule entitled On Humility. And some of a couple of the other steps, because I know we're not going to get to all 12, but one that jumped out at me, you label it Don't Speak Up, and Benedict will call it silence. And then I think it's one of the things that silence is one of the things that we in this culture really try to avoid at all costs. I have a family member who, if his wife and kids are out, he's got to look somebody up to have dinner with. The radio or the TV's on from the minute they get up till the minute they go to sleep. And they just, it's almost like there's a fear of silence. And
There is, because silence reminds us of emptiness and death ultimately. And during my novitiate, I took a class on the rule. So I translated the rule with an old monk of our monastery. He's 92 now. His name is Father Timothy. Great. He was special forces during World War II, and he's this immensely intimidating fellow. And every day I would show up late for class, and every day he'd be sitting with his fingertips touching, waiting for me to turn up. And I would have a different excuse every day, of course. And I'd say, "Oh, I'm so sorry, Father. I was cleaning the chalices, or I was, you know, late for whatever. Or I was taking a nap." And when I was finally done with all my excuses, he'd say, "Are we quite ready?"
Mm.
I say, "Yes, Father." Wow. He's British as well. In fact, his Father Timothy Horner is his name, and his great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was Little Jack Horner of the nursery rhyme, who sat in the corner with his thumbs in the pie. Yeah.
There you go.
But what's that?
I was just going to say, for the folks that are listening, you never know what you're going to learn on this show. So Little Jack Horner actually existed. And his great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandson is a Benedictine monk.
The last living member of the Horner line. But finally, you know, I finally did manage to get on time for class toward the end of my novitiate. And I made it to class one day, and Father Timothy was late. So I thought, oh, this is great. This is my chance to even the score. So I set out all my stuff real neatly like Father Timothy did, and I even sat in his chair. And I had my fingertips touching when he walked in, and he said, "Oh, I'm so sorry, I was busy." And I waited till he was done with his excuse, and I said, are we quite ready? Right? And he didn't say anything. He just took a little piece of paper out of his pocket and he put it on the table, and I unfolded it, and it said, silence is the first language of God.
Wow.
And yeah. I lost that piece of paper eventually, but I kept it with me for years because, you know, it. If I think back to my life on the beyond the cloister walls before I became a monk, I really had precious little silence. I, you know, wake up in the morning to the clock radio, eat breakfast to the radio, watch TV while I was eating breakfast, you know, go off to work, come back, listen to music while I run. I even had a radio in the shower, and that's a real shame if silence is the first language of God, you know?
Right. Yeah, and go ahead.
But surely God, you know, and the Trinity was communicating, was speaking to one another before we invented human language, right? So
right.
They must have been talking silence.
Yeah, I was just going to say it's the language of God is silence, that it's in that, mm-hmm. in those silent moments. And it's only, I think, in those silent moments where we can actually hear God's voice. And it took me a long time to realize that. And I think often of the passage in Scripture out of 1 Kings where, you know, God comes in that whisper. He doesn't come in the earthquake, and he doesn't come in the fire, that it's in that tiny little whisper. And especially when we're on retreat and we're trying to get the, you know, 200 guys to keep quiet so that people can hear God. And I often use that passage, you know, and if we're not silent, you're not going to hear that small whispering voice.
And right. Well, you're never going to hear other people either, for that matter. I mean, I don't. If you listen to two people fighting, they're almost always saying, aren't you listening to me? Can't you hear what I'm trying to say? You're not listening, you know.
Mm.
I have a nun friend named Sister Macrina who lives in Ireland now, I think. But she told me, you never answer a complaint without repeating it back to the person who made it. And I've tried. It's the best piece of advice I've never followed. But yeah. I repeat it to myself periodically.
Yeah, no, and I'm just thinking about how that would go. You know, somebody complains to you and you repeat the complaint.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. Very good. One of the other steps, and this would mean a lot to my 12-step friends, is step 6. And you label it, be someone's doormat. And Benedict would call it serenity. And,
yeah. Oh, right. Yeah. Serenity now.
Right. And in the beginning of the book here, it actually lists out the rules with the title and then a short verse. And in this case, it says, when ill treatment comes your way, try to accept it. Learn to be content with the lowliest and worst of everything and in all that is demanded of you. And how beautiful it is to be able to comprehend something like that and actually try to live that way, because sooner or later, and I think this is one of the things that people may struggle with the most when it comes to a relationship with God. You know, you hear that the question, you know, why does God allow bad things to happen to good people? And no matter who you are, you probably know somebody that has an addiction or a terminal illness or one of these things that, you know, really isn't so great. And trying to find God in those things can often be difficult, but I think when we do that, we even see how much more beautiful God is, that he doesn't inflict these things on us, that he allows these things to happen, and being able to accept them for what they are and give up the fight sometimes is really what brings serenity.
I have a friend who's a bitter ex-Catholic atheist, great guy, actually, for all of that. But he and I have been friends since grad school, and he used to say, the problem with you Catholics, he didn't consider himself a Catholic anymore, though I kept telling him, once you're baptized, there's no going back, too late,
right.
You're a Catholic, that's
yeah.
it. But indelible mark on the soul, like, it drove him crazy. But he said, the problem with Catholics is that when they're happy, they're happy, and when they're miserable, then they're really happy. And I tried to argue with it, but then I thought, you know, that's not a bad way to live. I mean, if you're happy even when you're miserable, then you've pretty well got it made. I mean,
no.
Life is nonstop joy. But, you know, you don't have to be everyone's doormat. It's just being someone's doormat every now and then is a good way to achieve, well, serenity, you know.
Mm-hmm.
One of the greatest, most underrated, and most unread church fathers is Dorotheus of Gaza. And if anybody's out there who wants to read a really good book for Lent, besides my book, they should buy a copy of The Conferences of Dorotheus of Gaza. And one of the things he says in it that I carry with me in my head all the time, he says, if your brother makes you angry, if your brother does something to anger you, don't be angry. You were a pile of dry leaves. He was just the breeze that blew you over.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, I think about that. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, we have a tendency, when we get angry, we say it's their fault. Well, your anger isn't someone else's fault.
Right.
You know?
Right. In the 12-step rooms, we'll often say, that if you're angry about something, you need to look inside and see what about you is causing that anger. Because
yeah.
a lot of times we'll get angry with a spouse or we'll get angry with a friend because whatever they said or did points out something that you know to be true about yourself, but you don't want anybody else to know about it. And so I oftentimes when anger or resentment comes up, it's an ideal time to sit back and look at yourself and say, you know, why am I getting so angry?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're watching TV and you're into a show and somebody changes the channel and you go off the wall. It usually has nothing to do with the channel being changed. It's something else that has been building up inside us.
Well, I have a friend who's a missionary of charity who told me a story about how she was in the Amazon and working with these people, and there were, I think, three other missionaries of charity sisters with her, and they had to live together in this little hut, and one of them left, and the other one, every night she would come in and close all the windows. And it was stifling, she said. She couldn't sleep. It was so hot in that little hut with the windows closed. And finally, this other nun had to leave for a night or two to get to do something. And she said, finally, I had a night of sleep with the windows open. She said, and when I woke up the next morning, the bed was full of snakes.
Wow.
So it's really that anger, you know, if we trust each other, if we assume that our friend, our husband or wife, you know, the people we live with, if we assume that they have our best interests in mind, then we don't jump straight to that anger. You know, I was reading somewhere about a psychological theory called the fundamental attribution error, which is a mouthful.
Mm.
But the idea is that when we do something sort of sketchy, we always attribute it to our circumstances. You know, why did I cut in line? Well, I'm in a terrible hurry. This is an emergency, or I didn't see the people behind me. But when someone else does something sketchy, we attribute it to their character. They're a jerk, right?
Right.
But if we're going to be really at peace with the world and fair with the people around us, you will give them the same benefit of the doubt that you expect them to give you. You know, why would a rational, decent person do this? Well, I don't know. Maybe he cut in line in front of me because he's in a hurry. Maybe he's in the middle of an emergency. Maybe he's having a horrible day and he's in a terrible mood and just didn't, you know, have the energy to wait in line. You know, maybe whatever. But the point is that George Carlin says that when you're on the highway, everybody going faster than you is a maniac. Everybody going slower than you is an idiot. And how is it that everybody, you're the only person on the highway driving the exact right speed?
Right.
You judge everybody else by their character. You judge yourself by the circumstances. Right.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's about serenity, is attributing the same, giving the same benefit of the doubt to others. But it's, you know, sorry, it's also about learning to live with yourself, learning to be comfortable with your weakness, learning to be comfortable alone, in silence, in solitude, Right. Just you and Jesus.
Often difficult. It's often difficult. And one of the most beautiful experiences I've had in my life is doing an 8-day silent retreat. And when I talk to people before and after, before I went, it's like, you're really going to go and not talk for 8 days? And it's not completely silent. You talk to the spiritual director. You are allowed to respond at Mass. But for the most part, it's silence. And I didn't know how it was going to be. And when I came back, people couldn't believe how much that I enjoyed it. And it wasn't so much an enjoyment. It was I learned so much about myself and about God and that relationship that I welcome silence now. As a matter of fact, there's times that I long for silence. Often you'll find it in Adoration Chapel or one of those places. But just to be able to get rid of all the noise, because what I've come to learn, and I'm sure anybody that's experienced some amount of silence, is that there's so many distractions. And I think that the evil one uses all this noise, whether it's the radio or TV or people talking or whatever the source of the noise is, uses it to serve as a distraction, because the more that we concentrate on what other people are saying and what's going on around us, the less time that we focus on God and focus on ourselves. And I think that what your book does, and probably the most important thing, it makes us take a look at ourselves. And I think that for a lot of people, that's the hardest thing in the world to do. We don't want to look at ourselves. And the flip side of that is that if you study the lives of the saints, that's where, for a lot of them, that's where it began, that they would take a look at themselves. They would understand who they were. They would understand who they were, especially in relationship to God. And some of the things that we've been talking about today, that's where it grows out of, that dependence on God. You're only going to be dependent on God if you know your limitations and that he can fulfill them. If you don't understand that, why would I give up what I believe or what I want to do and turn my life over to God? Unless we understand that relationship. And I don't think we can get there in a noisy world. That we all of us at some interval, hopefully daily, but at least weekly, can take that time out and step out and try to experience that silence. And it can be hard. If you're new at it, after a couple of minutes of absolute silence, you start going stir crazy and looking around. But it's something that can certainly, and I'm sure you can attest to this, especially being in a monastery, that over time that you can come to really appreciate that silence.
Oh, I crave it. When I've been running around giving these book tours and talks and stuff, and if I, after a couple of days, I'm like going through withdrawals.
Yeah. Well, we're just about, believe it or not, at the top of the hour. So the hour has
already.
And my guest and wonderful guest has been Father Augustine Weta. He's a Benedictine monk. He's written this wonderful book called Humility Rules, and it's available, or it's published by Ignatius. You can certainly get it at Ignatius.com and other retailers. It's available in paperback as well as electronic format. So if you got a Kindle or even the free Kindle app on your phone, you can read it on your cell phone. Highly recommended. I don't have much of a following here, Father, but I get a few 12-step friends that are listening, I'm sure. And
good.
If they are, I would really encourage you to pick this book up. And
great.
As a matter of fact, I ordered 3 copies myself on the break.
Fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. So highly recommend it. And like you said, Father, you've been doing these tours and running around, and I really, really want to thank you for taking an hour out of your busy life to spend with us.
My pleasure.
Hopefully it translates into a few book sales. And if nothing else, I'm sure our audience gleaned quite a bit of information, much needed.
Well, I've learned a thing or two myself, so
very good.
Thank you. I feel like I've been sitting by someone's kitchen just having a conversation.
That's what we say, especially the show that I had before this is with a good priest friend of mine. It's like we're sitting in the living room and we invite people to call in and join us in the living room. But hopefully somewhere around here I can get your personal contact information and keep in touch, especially if you come out with something new.
Great.
All right.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
And thanks for being
God
here.
Bless.
God bless. Mm-hmm. So, again, folks, that was Father Augustine Weta, Benedictine monk, and he's written this wonderful book called Humility Rules. The hour has flown by for me. When I took a look at the book earlier this week and knew he was coming on, I knew it was going to be a great show, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I have. And as always, I really look forward to being with you again next Wednesday. Until then, I pray that God will hold you in the palm of his hand. Take care, and God bless.